Hello and welcome to the Symantec Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Bridget O'Gorman, and joining me today are Symantec threat researchers Alan Neville and John Paul Power. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about a critical vulnerability in Windows Remote Procedure Call Runtime Protocol, the shutdown of two well-known dark marketplaces, and the emergence of a new marketplace offering stolen data for sale. But first, we will talk about some of the new research that Symantec has published in the past couple of weeks. And we will talk about some new research we have done into the Russia-backed Shukram group shortly. But first, Alan, we published some new research into a Lazarus Dream Job campaign last week. And maybe before we start talking about this specific blog, do you want to give us some background on Dream Job and maybe talk about some of the previous activity we have seen under this banner?
Yeah, sure. So there's actually been quite a bit of reporting about this group over several years now. So like initially Dream Job's campaigns were first published by our colleagues in ESES in a blog in, I think it was around June 2020. And they specifically detailed a campaign which was focused on attacking the defense and aerospace companies in Europe and in the Middle East between September and December 2019. And in that campaign, which they had actually named Interception, was where they detailed some malicious files that was downloaded, made wide use of social engineering, and relied on modular malware to collect and perform reconnaissance on targeted networks. And according to ESET, the attackers made initial contacts with the targets through LinkedIn. And this was a little bit unusual, where we hadn't seen something like this before. So the attackers essentially created profiles impersonating human resource recruiters from international companies in the defense and aerospace sectors. And these copycat profiles were used to send job offers to those targets. And if those targets showed any interest, they would essentially send a password protected archive directly to them, or like something that was linked to one of the cloud service providers like OneDrive. In the archive was a linked file, which runs several commands. One of the first ones was a remote PDF. So this was essentially used as a decoy. So opening like a job offer or some document. Second, the folder was created, which had some WMI commands lines as well. Essentially copying the files under different names, finally creating scheduled tasks. And all this was this essentially done to ensure initial persistence on those infected machines. Then later in July, our colleagues at McAfee documented a similar campaign in their blog, where they had talked about some malicious documents that were being sent to individuals related to legitimate job offers at leading defense contractors. All of these organizations that were targeted had active defense contracts of varying sizes and scope within the US government. And then later, ClearSky also released a pretty thorough report where they detailed some further tactics these attackers were undertaking. So, for example, they began to impersonate legitimate individuals and companies, copying their LinkedIn profiles, using their images. They began to essentially build up like a reputation, adding other individuals at those companies before reaching out to their targets with essentially job offers as well. In those cases, they began leveraging other messaging platforms as well to engage with those targets. So there were things like WhatsApp or SMS and Twitter. And then in January, Google had published a blog where they had observed similar campaigns again. But in these cases, the attackers had shifted their focus away from defense and aeronautics to essentially start targeting security researchers. In these campaigns, the attackers had begun to impersonate professional security researchers, setting up again, LinkedIn profiles, but also some Twitter accounts. And they had gone further in these cases, where they started to create blogs, publishing articles on exploit vulnerability research, in an attempt to build up some of their reputation within the industry. At one stage, they even created a fake YouTube video, supposedly demoing a zero-day exploit against Windows Defender. But this was later proven to be a fake exploit. But again, once they had actually built up these reputations, they began reaching out to other security researchers asking if they wanted to collaborate on some vulnerability research. And this was particularly interesting And as part of that attack, they would send a Visual Studio project, which had additional DLL files embedded within them. And these would be executed as part of the Visual Studio build events to install their malware on those machines. Now, at around the same time, Microsoft also published a blog detailing the same campaign targeting security researchers. They were able to provide a bit more technical details and context around the malware that the group were delivering, where they had documented a custom backdoor being used by the group called Comebacker. And at this point, we believe the group were targeting security researchers likely to gain access to systems to retrieve exploits that they could potentially leverage in future attacks against other industries as well.
Okay, that's a really good overview, Alan. Thanks. So this is obviously like a very kind of long running campaign, I suppose, that's been going on for a little while. But do you want to maybe tell us a bit more about this recent activity that we've seen?
Yeah, so during this time, Symantec had been tracking the group under the name Pompilius. And around late, I think it was 2021, we observed a shift in the targeting, whereby they began to focus on healthcare and pharmaceuticals organizations, retaining access in those organizations for up to several months at a time. Similar to what was previously reported, we observed the attackers leveraging various social media platforms, sending malicious documents with lures related to either pharmaceutical or their targets of interest, and identified a potentially new and documented vector as well, whereby the attackers were installing their tools via legitimate system management software tools to spread across the networks. We'd also observed the attackers targeting financial organizations that were heavy into cryptocurrency trading at the time, but this wasn't really something new for Lazarus. It's generally a way for them to circumvent some of the sanctions imposed by them or on them by other countries. So as we continue to monitor the group into 2021 and 2022, we noticed another shift in targeting, whereby they began to set their sights on organizations operating in the information technology sector. And these organizations included companies like web hosting, small-time registrars, IT support contractors, and then they later start shifting towards conglomerates. And now we believe they may have targeted organizations in the IT sector to build out some of their infrastructure. The majority of their command and control servers, for example, were compromised websites. However, we also believe there's a real possibility there that they were targeting these organizations as a means to gain access to other organizations of interest, essentially performing a supply chain attack. And we noticed some of the other victims that we had identified around this time were actually partnered with some of the IT contractors.
Okay, I mean, that's all pretty interesting. And then we were actually able as well to get a pretty good insight into the attack chain in one victim of this recent activity as well. So do you maybe want to walk us through that a little bit as well?
Yeah, of course. So in one recent victim who operates within the chemical sector, we observed Lazarus sending what we believe was a malicious email that contained a link to a remote site. The user that the email was delivered to would click that link, which in turn downloaded a malicious DLL file to install their backdoor. Once executed, the DLL downloaded a second stage backdoor, which allowed the attackers to execute in-memory payloads, effectively allowing them to run arbitrary commands, install additional tools, and potentially steal information from those infected machines. In multiple cases, we observed the attackers leveraging Trojanized versions of legitimate projects, such as like compression libraries and even some other system management software, likely to remain under the radar while executing these commands. After the attackers gained this initial access, we observed them collecting credentials to assist in some lateral movement. The attackers created multiple scheduled tasks to ensure persistence as a means to run their malicious commands. These were essentially done as batch files on those infected machines. And we also observed them installing older versions of Bitdefender, which was vulnerable to a remote code execution vulnerability, to execute some of those arbitrary commands and harder to reach systems within those networks. Beyond the backdoor tools and remote access tools that they were using, they had also deployed tools to take screenshots to monitor the machines of interest. And this tool would take screenshots of browse web pages every 10 seconds and send it back to their own infrastructure. And based on our research more recently into these victims, we were able to confirm that the targets in most cases had a working relationship in some form or other. They'd also based on the machines that they appeared to be of interest to the attackers, it was clear they were interested in information pertaining to chemical research, specifically epoxy development research. And as we all know, North Korea are largely excommunicated from the wider scientific community. And we believe that they have been targeting these organizations to steal this type of information as a means to further their missile and nuclear programs.
Yeah, so I was about to ask you, like, why do we think they're targeting the chemical sector in this campaign? But I suppose that sort of half answers the question there, really.
Yeah, so essentially, if I take a step back, so as we began to dig into the conglomerate victims, we quickly realized the attackers were clearly interested in chemical research. So those organizations that they had targeted and compromised had working relationships with each other, and we could see them specifically seeking out research materials related to this epoxy research that the organizations were collaborating on. What was interesting about epoxy, it's not just glue. Essentially, it can be used for other practical uses as well, among some of them being solid state fuels. And as we know, North Korea have ramped up some of their missile testing since the beginning of 2022. And it's likely due to the sanctions imposed on the country and the fact that they're excluded from that wider scientific community, that they're resorting to stealing this research. Again, to further their own nuclear programs. What's also interesting about this is that we've seen other North Korean groups targeting the chemical sector for similar research in the past. And this was a group that we call or track as Stonefly, which we've blogged about it before. At that time, they had been targeting conglomerates as well, involved in research around super alloys. And this was specifically used for heat shielding. And again, it all kind of ties together where it appears to be either some directive that's been passed down to these groups for them to essentially collect this type of information to further their own missile testing or nuclear program efforts.
Yeah, it does definitely sound like that. And I suppose on a kind of a related question, I think last week as well, just after we published this blog, US authorities announced a $5 million reward for information about, you know, the Lazarus gang who are behind all these many of these attacks. So I suppose a good question is, do you think that kind of announcement is actually likely to impact the gang's activity going forward?
I suppose, quite honestly, I believe it's unlikely to have a major impact on the gang's activity. I suppose while information on their activity may be useful to these authorities, particularly on individuals that may be operating outside of North Korea, it'll be super unlikely that anyone involved will either be tried in a court of law or let alone even extradited to the US. I believe these types of announcements are more of a warning, essentially, or a message to those potentially assisting North Korea and probably to the North Korean government themselves, that the US are prioritizing tracking of their activities.
Yeah, that they're keeping an eye on things. That's great, Alan. Thanks for that. It's a really good overview of that activity. But we also published another blog this week. We've been busy. About Shookworm, who we have talked about on this podcast before. But Alan, just in case anyone missed that, do you want to maybe give us a quick overview of who Shookworm is before we talk about this most recent activity that we've seen?
Yeah, so Shookworm is actually a group that we've blogged about before, not just this week, but also at the end of January of this year, of where we had observed them launching attacks against organizations in the Ukraine. The group themselves have been active since at least 2013, specializing in cyber espionage campaigns, using phishing emails to distribute either freely available remote access tools, such as remote manipulator service or RMS, and other tools like UltraVNC or customized malware that they have developed to the targets. And around that time, a report published by the security services of Ukraine, or the SSU, noted that Shukram's activity have grown in some sophistication in recent times, with the attackers now living off the land tools or using off the land tools to steal credentials and move laterally on those victim networks. And even recent activity seen by Symantec is somewhat consistent with what has been documented by the SSU.
Yeah, and I suppose, so then maybe what did we see with this most recent activity that we've just blogged about?
So more recently, we've observed Shukram continued their operations against organizations in the Ukraine using variants of their backdoors, which we can see have been tailored towards their victims and use unique command and control servers, for example, per victim. From what we have been able to discover so far, it appears that these organizations may include government entities. However, we're still continuing to track and investigate the group's activities and their targeting of these Ukrainian organizations. I suppose in the most recent wave of attacks against Ukrainian orgs, so we've identified at least 4 new variants of their backdoor, along with additional tools they have deployed, such as UltraVNC, as we mentioned before, for remote desktop access, and leveraging other tools such as sysinternal system administration tools.
Okay, and I mean, clearly Shukram is a very kind of active threat, but I guess how big of a threat would we consider this group to organizations in Ukraine?
I suppose while Shukram is not the most technically sophisticated espionage group, it compensates for this in its focus and its persistence in relentlessly targeting Ukrainian organizations. It appears that their backdoor has been continuously redeveloped by the attackers in a bid to stay ahead of detection and essentially to remain under the radar. But while Shukram appears to be largely focused on intelligence gathering, its attacks could also potentially be a precursor to more serious intrusions. For example, if the access it acquires to some of these Ukrainian organizations is turned over to other Russian-sponsored actors, there is a very big potential for the likes of sabotage or even disruption attacks, where we've known Russian actors perform those type of attacks in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something we'll be keeping an eye on going forward. That's great, Alan. Thanks very much for that. So I guess moving on from our own kind of research, JP, there were a couple of stories you wanted to talk about that were in the news over the last couple of weeks as well, including a couple of law enforcement takedown operations.
Yeah, there were actually 2 takedowns in as many weeks, both involving US law enforcement working with their counterparts in Europe to shut down 2 dark net marketplaces. So the marketplace known as Hydra Market was the first one to be hit. Hydra's speciality was dealing in illegal drugs and money laundering services. And it was actually one of the older marketplaces, having been running since around 2015. Like a lot of these darknet marketplaces, it worked kind of like a highly illegal version of eBay, where criminals can open up an account and start selling their products and services. And then the Hydra operators get a commission for everything sold on the site. So as well as dealing in things like cocaine, methamphetamine, LSD, heroin, you know, all the classics. Customers could also buy fake passports and other forms of ID, as well as ransomware and things like that. But that all came to an end on April 5th, when German federal agents working with US law enforcement seized Hydra servers, as well as crypto wallets containing around $25 million worth of Bitcoin. Then just 24 hours later, on April 6th, the US Justice Department announced that it was bringing criminal charges against an alleged Hydra operator and administrator, a 30-year-old Russian man named Dmitry Olegovich Pavlov. So he's accused of using the marketplace to distribute narcotics and launder money. And then on top of all that, the US Treasury Department issued sanctions against Hydra after it identified around 100 virtual currency addresses associated with the marketplace, which were used for illicit transactions. Now, those sanctions mean that it is now an offense for anyone in the US to have any dealings with any of those addresses. So this particular takedown was fairly significant. So just to give you an idea of how popular Hydra Market was, it had around 17 million users. And then last year alone, so in 2021, it accounted for around 80% of all dark web market-related cryptocurrency transactions. And since it first hit the scene back in 2015, it's after taking in about 5.2 billion in transactions. So all in all, that was a pretty big win for law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that was a really significant takedown. And you said there was another takedown in the last couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, so just a week after Hydra was taken down, another pretty big illegal marketplace known as Raid Forums was shut down. Well, it was actually an announcement was made to say it had been shut down. So the website actually went offline almost a month ago. But law enforcement just issued press releases for it on April 12th. So Raid Forums was also established in 2015. So it's another OG marketplace, been around for quite a while. But it only had about 500,000 users compared to Hydra, so a lot less. But it specialized in selling access to info from data breaches carried out against high-profile corporations around the world. That info could include things like payment card data, bank account numbers, and routing information, as well as usernames and passwords used to access online accounts. And similar to Hydra, Raid was taken down in a joint effort by US and European law enforcement. One of the chief admins was also arrested, this time a 21-year-old named Diogo Santos Colo. He was arrested in the UK, but it's looking like he'll probably be extradited to the US, as quite a few US orgs had their data offered for sale on Raid Forums. The takedown operation itself was called Operation Tourniquet. And it took about a year's worth of preparation and investigation before it all came to a head in late February when the website's infrastructure was seized. It was a coordinated effort by Europol's European Cybercrime Center, who worked closely with the US Secret Service, the FBI, the IRS, and a number of agencies in the UK, Sweden, Romania, Portugal, and Germany. So it was a real group effort, this one.
Yeah, it was clearly a lot of work. And I remember reading, when I read that story during the week, I was amazed at how young the guy who has been arrested is, at like 21, considering this has been on the go since 2015. Like, it's something else, really.
I could barely tie my own shoelaces when I was 21.
Seriously. Like. But I suppose, I mean, that's kind of good news for a change, you know, two sort of major takedowns of two major well-known marketplaces.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's not all good news. So just like that game Whack-A-Mole, as soon as you take down one or two of these marketplaces, a new one always seems to pop up to take its place. And the new contender this time is a marketplace called Industrial Spy. And like most of these online bazaars, it sells data stolen from breach companies and is even offering some of that data for free for its paid-up members. But what makes this marketplace stand out is the way it's being promoted. So it's advertising itself as a place where businesses can get their hands on competitor data, such as manufacturing diagrams, accounting reports, client databases, and other kind of trade secrets like that. It also has something for all budgets. So it has so-called premium data packages, which go for like up to millions of dollars. All the way down to individual files, which can be bought for as little as just $2. The marketplace is also advertised in a kind of interesting way as well. So researchers found out about it through malware executable files that create a text file called README in every folder on a compromised machine. This README file contains a description of the marketplace and what it offers, as well as a link to the website, which is hosted on the Tor network. It also looks like the operators are using malware downloaders to get their advertisements onto, I guess, what they hope will be future customers' computers. So it's certainly a novel approach anyway. But the researchers also had a look at some of the data available on Industrial Spy. And it appears a good chunk of it is from organizations that have been hit with ransomware recently. So it looks like at least some of the data being sold on the site may have been downloaded from ransomware gang data leak websites. But it's early days yet, anyway, for industrial spy. So we'll have to wait and see if it becomes as popular as the two that were recently taken down.
Yeah, it's a different kind of a setup, all right, it seems. But hopefully this one will eventually get shut down as well. I think, JP, then finally, you also wanted to talk about a vulnerability that's been raising some concerns over the last couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, so last week we had a Patch Tuesday, which, as usual, saw Microsoft issue fixes for a bunch of vulnerabilities in its products, including a handful of critical ones. Now, any critical bug should get your attention, but this month there was one in particular that had that seemed to be getting people a bit more worried than usual due to its potential for widespread significant cyber attacks once an exploit is developed. We all know by now that that's almost guaranteed when it comes to a serious flaw like this. The bug itself was a Windows Remote Procedure Call Runtime Vulnerability, or RPC for short. RPC is a communications protocol that allows processes to communicate with each other, even if programs are running on different machines. The bug, which had a CVE number of 2022-26809, it allows for unauthorized remote code execution. So someone exploiting the bug would be able to execute commands at the same privilege level as the RPC server, which in many cases has elevated or system level permissions. And then to make matters even worse, the issue may also be wormable. So yeah, not good.
Yeah, that sounds pretty serious, all right.
Yeah, but luckily Microsoft has a fix available. So as long as people get patching quickly, we should all be fine. Although famous last words and all that.
Yeah, you never want to assume. That's great. Thanks, JP. So I think that's about all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. And if you'd like to read our latest research, including those blogs Alan and I were discussing about Shookworm and the Lazarus Group, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.